If you're living in the Northern Hemisphere, we've just hit the best time of the year. The world is exploding in shades of red, gold, and green. Pumpkin beers have found their way back to store shelves, and it's spooky season, my favorite time of the year. And if you're like me and many of my friends, you're trying to watch as many horror movies as you can before that magical day, October 31st. And that got me thinking, what might possibly be my top five favorite horror movies of all time? Welcome back to Space Castle, everybody. It's your clubhouse for all things nerdy. My name is DT. Grab a drink, grab some candy corn, throw that candy corn away, get something better to snack on, and let's jump into my top five favorite horror movies of all time. At number five, we've got An American Werewolf in London. It's an all-time classic. It came out in 1981. It was directed by John Landis, who is actually known more for doing comedies at the time. He was known for doing National Lampoon's Animal House. He did Blues Brothers, a number of other really funny movies. And that sense of humor absolutely carries over into An American Werewolf in London. It's an incredibly dark comedy, but it's also hysterical. It's very gory and bloody and intense. It's wonderful. It stars David Naughton as David, Jenny Agutter as Nurse Alex. And if you have been alive for the last 50 years, then at one point or another, you have had a crush on Jenny Agutter. She's just incomparable. And it also stars Griffin Dunn as Jack. So the movie starts out with a couple of friends backpacking through Europe, and they're in London, and they get attacked by a wolf. Jack is sadly killed. David survives, but is afraid that at some point he might turn into a werewolf. To make things worse, his best friend Jack, who's recently deceased, is haunting him in various states of decay, and warning him that he should just fucking kill himself before he turns into a werewolf and starts killing other people. David resists because he's got the hots for Alex, who he ends up staying with. Things go horribly wrong. He actually does end up turning into a werewolf. Kills a bunch of people, ends up being killed in the end, much to Alex's dismay. It's a wonderfully hysterical and biting satire. It's so much fun, and that ending comes out of left field and just smacks you in the face. I'm sure when it first came out, a lot of people who saw it in theaters were really confused. It took me a little while to warm to it, honestly. It's one of those endings where it's so abrupt that you just can't help but laugh. It's got that John Landis sense of humor to it, absolutely 100%. And you cannot talk about An American Werewolf in London without talking about the amazing, fantastic special effects by Rick Baker. Rick Baker was one of the quintessential masters of special and practical effects in movies. Just an absolute virtuoso. He really broke onto the scene of this movie. And still to this day, I go back and I watch David's transformation scene into a werewolf. And I'm always blown away at the prosthetics and the makeup and just how everything was conceived and put together. Rick Baker went on, of course, to do very famous makeup for the Thriller music video starring Michael Jackson, another quintessential example of amazing practical effects. He revolutionized the practical makeup industry for movies. Unfortunately, he's largely retired today. The filmmaking process got to the point where everything is all computer generated. And unfortunately, that just wasn't a world for Rick Baker to live and thrive in anymore. So he willfully retired somewhat. He still comes back every once in a while to do some cool projects here and there, but in his own words, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, movies just wanted to be done faster and cheaper, and that's not what he does at all. He does super high quality stuff, and it costs what it costs. So unfortunately, we live in an age with CGI blood squibs and monster transformations and blue screen backgrounds. And it needs to be said that Rick Baker was pretty much the reason why the practical effects Oscar was invented. He was the award's inaugural winner, and he still to this day holds the record for the number of nominations and wins. The man is just the master. So, pay tribute to him by going and watching An American Werewolf in London, directed by John Landis, came out in 1981. It is number five in my top five favorite horror movies of all time. Coming in at number four, we've got Night of the Living Dead, a 1968 film by John Romero. It is the quintessential zombie movie, and it not only kicked off that entire genre of horror movies, it also struck the horror movie industry like a bolt of lightning. This is an incredible film that's not only creepy and scary and wonderful to this day, it's also incredibly biting in its social commentary. It was very, very rare for a movie like this to have a black man as the protagonist. Not only is it the fact that the main protagonist of this movie is a black man that makes it incredible, it's also the fact that this black protagonist is also the sane foundation of the cast of characters. He's keeping people in line, he's smacking them around when they get delirious and hysterical, and he's like the one driving force for their survival. He's the one with his head on his shoulders, with a plan, trying to pull everybody together and survive this zombie invasion. And then the movie, of course, ends, spoiler alert, with him being the lone survivor. And he tries to escape the house he's been trapped in for the duration of this movie, surrounded by a bunch of white men with guns, and they just immediately open fire as soon as they see him. It's incredibly biting and saddening and poignant storytelling in that this one man who is fighting tooth and nail to keep a bunch of white people alive ends up being murdered by a bunch of white people who shoot first and don't ask questions simply because of the color of his skin. And that's the kind of filmmaker George Romero is. He's a revolutionary. He does not give a shit what you think. He's going to tell it like it is. And this movie absolutely does so. It tells a very succinct and very poignant and very important story about racism and class warfare covered in this sort of blanket of this zombie apocalypse. The movie is incredible. It's absolutely amazing. There's a funny story that goes along with this movie as well. The movie is actually in public domain, which is incredible and insane. And this is why. So the movie was in production with the title The Night of the Flesh Eaters. And the movie had been copyrighted with that title. But what happened was they decided to change it at the last minute because they felt that the title was not beneficial to the film. It was a little bit too gruesome. So they changed it to Night of the Living Dead. And this also accounts for the reason why night, the word night in the title card of the film, is actually in a different font from everything else. It was a completely last second change. However, when they went to produce and distribute the movie, the copyright was not updated. So Night of the Living Dead, as it is titled, is not officially copyrighted, and it can't be copyrighted because now it's moved on to public domain, which is amazing. So you're able to see it in such places as like At the Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs, where he can play it and comment to his heart's content with very little to do in terms of royalties and having to get clearance to air the movie. I don't know if you can like throw it on YouTube and just do commentary yourself for the entire movie. I would have to do more research on that. There's probably some loopholes and stipulations, but yeah, the movie is actually public domain, which is insane because it's one of the quintessential works of art as far as horror movies, and honestly, one of the best movies ever made. Like I said, it's a bona fide classic, and it revitalized an entire industry of filmmaking. George A. Romero, you are the master. Next up at number three, we've got A Nightmare on Elm Street, directed by Wes Craven. It came out in 1984. It stars Heather Langenkamp as Nancy, Robert Englund as the horrible, wonderful, fantastic Freddy Krueger. It was also the first appearance in a major motion picture by Johnny Depp. Let me preface this by saying that still to this day, I'm creeped out by Freddy Krueger, and he absolutely ruined my fucking childhood. I lost so many nights of sleep to Robert Englund and that wonderful, fantastic makeup and costume. I honestly think that it was diminishing returns with the franchise from the first movie on, but A Nightmare on Elm Street, I think, is one of the most amazing technical achievements in the realm of horror filmmaking and filmmaking in general, and it's still to this day, I think, one of the scariest horror movies ever made. Of course, it stars Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger, who was accused of being a child murderer. So all the parents in the town where he was accused band together, they end up murdering him, and they think all is good and well. They think he's gone forever. And then the children of Elm Street in this neighborhood start disappearing and start being murdered and dying horrible, brutal deaths that can't be explained. The heroes learn that it's actually Freddy Krueger come back from the grave to kill all the children in revenge for the parents who had killed him. And the twist in all of this is that Freddy stalks his victims and kills them in their dreams while they're asleep. And that's what makes Freddy so goddamn scary, is the fact that everybody has to sleep. We need to sleep like 6 to 8 hours a night. At least I do. Otherwise, I'm fucking cranky and I'm a useless piece of shit. But everybody has to sleep. And that's when you're at your most vulnerable, and that is when Freddy can get at you, and you can't escape him because you can't make yourself wake up. It's a wonderfully twisted tale. It scares the shit out of you long after you're done watching it. Robert Englund, like I said before, is just absolutely hysterical and funny and horrifying and terrifying, and there is shit in this movie that still creeps me out and makes my skin crawl. There's that scene, of course, where Nancy's friend Tina is brutally murdered in her bed, and Freddy Krueger, who we can't see because she's asleep, and he's killing her in her sleep, is being dragged up and down this wall and the ceiling of the bedroom, and there's blood all over the fucking place. They did it, of course, with a rotating set. The effect is so goddamn convincing and so creepy and just horrifying that it's still stuck in my head to this day. I still get a little queasy and a little uncomfortable watching it, and I watch the movie at least once a year. Wes Craven was just a goddamn fucking master. He was inspired, of course, by his own nightmares, and he took those nightmares and turned them into nightmares for me from the age of like 6 or 7 on. And, you know, rest in peace, sir. You were just one of the absolute artists when it came to horror and slasher movies. And then later in his career, he was able to actually go back and sort of lampoon himself with Scream. And he did so in a way where he actually revitalized the genre once more and created a whole new generation of horror slasher fans with what was honestly a very deftly and succinctly crafted film. So, Wes, we miss you. And Robert Englund, you're never allowed to pass away because we need you around forever. You're an absolute gem. Love you, sir. Coming in at number two, we've got The Thing. Came out in 1982. It was directed by John Carpenter. It stars Kurt Russell, Keith David, and Wilford Brimley, who you probably most remember from oatmeal commercials and the man who scared the shit out of you about diabetes when you were 8 years old like me. I think still to this day, Wilford Brimley, who is a delightful actor and is fantastic in this movie, is still always and forever going to be known as the diabetes guy. But thank goodness for him, man, because it raised my awareness for diabetes. I'm sure it raised the awareness of a lot of other people and hopefully saved some lives. So the man's a gem. The Thing takes place in Antarctica. A bunch of scientists unearth and discover an extraterrestrial being that can consume and take the shape of whatever being it consumes. So what ensues is a wonderful, horrible, graphic, disgusting, bloody, gory, gooey fucking movie that is not only a wonderful horror and slasher film, it's also sort of a whodunit storyline wherein all the scientists are suspicious of each other because they don't know who might actually be the thing and who's not, including the dog. The special effects for this movie, the practical effects on set, are still some of the absolute best I've ever fucking seen. The defibrillator scene, if you've seen this movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If not, go watch this movie right away. It is still fucking shocking. It still makes me jump to this day. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. Kurt Russell puts on an amazing performance as MacReady, our hero. Keith David, who is cool as fuck. He was Spawn. He was fucking Goliath from Gargoyles. He plays Childs in this, and he is fantastic as well. The cast is wonderful. They're firing on all cylinders. This is an absolute quintessential thriller. I personally think John Carpenter is the absolute master of horror movies and practical effects on set. And The Thing is undisputed as number two on my top five favorite horror movies list. And Goldblum, the Space Castle's onboard AI, is telling me that before we get to my number one pick for the best horror film of all time, we need to check in with some messages from Earth and hear from one of our friends at an excellent indie podcast.
This one I'm going to call the Fireface Margarita.
Should have just owned it too. Just have Patrick Wilson play Josh and Patrick Wilson play Ed. And then
just add sideburns.
Act like it's normal.
She has a drink and she pours the whiskey down the grave. That raises the dead. And he comes back and enacts revenge.
Then not dead, but then dead, but then not dead, but then they're actually dead. And they're like, oh, okay, cool. And then suddenly they're not dead again.
This is Eric.
And this is Vivi.
And we host the Shaken Not Scared podcast.
Join us every Wednesday as we talk about a modern or classic horror movie while drinking a spooky cocktail to go with it.
With our pub Loki. He doesn't drink, we do.
Listen to us anywhere you get your podcast. Okay, thanks, bye.
Bye.
And coming in at number one of my top five favorite horror movies of all time, you probably saw this coming. It's Halloween, 1978, John Carpenter, stars Jamie Lee Curtis and Donald Pleasance. I think it might be the quintessential horror slash slasher movie of all time. It is my absolute favorite horror movie. I revisit it every single year around this time. And it is not Halloween until Laurie Strode stabs Michael Myers in the eye with a coat hanger. It's an independent movie that was directed by John Carpenter, and he also happened to write the score himself. That wonderfully awesome, scary, terrifying fucking synth score that he played on a fucking keyboard. That amazing theme that is still one of the most iconic horror or movie themes ever. The movie takes place in the fictional town of Haddonfield, Illinois. Starts out with Michael Myers as a child, where he inexplicably murders his older sister. And we learn that Michael Myers is just pure fucking evil. And that's one of the things I love most about Halloween and Michael Myers as a character, is the fact that we only learn his motivation for coming back and killing all these people in small doses. At first, we think he's just this embodiment of evil, this soulless, lifeless husk of a man who's just here to wreak havoc on Halloween and just kill a bunch of teenagers. We learn that, yeah, he actually is pure goddamn evil. He's pretty much just the devil incarnate, but he's not soulless. He's an artist when it comes to killing teenagers, and he almost takes this weird sadistic pride in doing so. There's that very famous scene where he grabs a teenage boy by the neck and he holds him up against the wall. He stabs him through the chest so that the knife holds him up against the wall, and he stands back and he tilts his head. And he just kind of admires his handiwork. And of course, there's that very important scene where he puts the headstone of his sister Judith's grave, the sister he killed when he was a child, on display as a means of terrifying and spooking the shit out of the people he's currently stalking and trying to kill. Michael Myers has a twisted fucking sense of humor. He is an artist when it comes to killing people. He takes great care in doing so. He's a wonderfully terrifying villain, one of the quintessential slasher villains of all time. And there's a reason why so many people dress up as him for Halloween. I have vivid memories of this one guy who used to do it in my grandparents' neighborhood. And it was a pretty nice neighborhood. You know, we got all the full-size candy bars and shit. There was always this one guy who did the whole overalls costume with the Michael Myers mask and the fucking kitchen knife. And he would just stand out in front of his house like he was a statue, like he was like a mannequin dressed up as Michael Myers. He had a dry ice machine, so there was fog rolling down the fucking driveway. And he had just very, very softly that Halloween theme playing from his front porch. And he wouldn't mess with the little kids, which is really cool. Kids would walk up and walk past him and get their candy and then run away. And then it was the bigger kids that came up, or like the adults, that he would, you know, all of a sudden come to life and jump scare them. It was fantastic. I don't know what that guy's name was. I don't know if he's even still alive to this day, but it's kind of funny that that random stranger and Michael Myers in general is such a quintessential Halloween memory for me from my childhood. But yeah, man, John Carpenter, he really kind of jumped onto the scene with Assault on Precinct 13, but it was Halloween that really put him over the top. Of course, he went on to do The Fog. He wanted to do The Thing. Before that, he did Escape from New York. He and Kurt Russell had a pretty good working relationship. They worked together multiple times. He did Starman with Jeff Bridges, which I still think is an underrated classic, honestly. Big Trouble in Little China, which is just an incredible film, also starring Kurt Russell. One of the most gonzo fucking bonkers 80s movies ever. Highly recommend seeing if you haven't. If you don't understand it and don't get it the first time, it's okay. Jack Burton's not the hero. There's a little hint for you. He's actually the sidekick, which is wonderful. He did They Live with Roddy Piper, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And of course, he did Vampires and Ghosts of Mars, but we don't really have to talk about those. It's okay. Halloween to this day is still one of the most revisited horror slasher film franchises of all time. Of course, there was the first two, the first one being my favorite horror movie of all time. The second one, I think, is a very, very solid follow-up. Number three, follow through with John Carpenter's original idea of having the Halloween franchise be a sort of anthology. It was supposed to be sort of akin to The Twilight Zone, where every new movie was going to be a different story with a different villain slash monster, and you were going to get something different every time you revisited the franchise. This experiment culminated with Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which was not very well received because obviously it didn't star Michael Myers, it threw people for a loop, and it's regarded largely as not being a great movie. However, it does have a great cult following now, and it's grown to be appreciated by a lot of people, myself included. I saw it for the first time as a kid, and I really didn't understand it. I just wanted more Michael Myers to jump out and scare the shit out of me. As an adult, I actually really fucking enjoy Season of the Witch. It's gooey, it's gross, it's a little bit shrill, it's got a great cast, it's kind of gonzo and all over the place, really bonkers. The plot is kind of fucking nonsense, but a blast at the same time. It's one of those bad horror movies that is good because it's so bad. And that's one of the things I love about the horror genre in general is the fact that a really bad horror movie with good intentions can sometimes be just as good as a legitimately good horror movie with really solid artistry. The franchise moved back to Michael Myers with Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, which I still kind of dig because you can tell it was a labor of love. It was produced by a group of people who wanted to bring the franchise back to its former glory. It's a noble failure, but I still have a lot of fun with it just because I dig Michael Myers. And then everything goes off the fucking rails with Halloween 5, The Curse of Michael Myers. The whole Cult of the Thorn stuff is bizarre and weird and kind of deflates what makes Michael Myers scary in the first place. And from there, the whole franchise just goes off the fucking rails, unless you're a fan of Busta Rhymes. And of course, we had that reboot by Rob Zombie, and the less said about that, the better. My really good friend Rena, who is one of the biggest horror aficionados I know, says that Rob Zombie pretty much peaked with House of 1,000 Corpses, and I tend to agree. I kind of feel like Rob Zombie is a filmmaker who doesn't really understand the core concept or the meaning behind the projects he's adapting. For that reason, I'm probably never going to see the Munsters movie he just put out. Michael Myers doesn't need to be given a ton of backstory. We just need to know that he's a sadistic son of a bitch. He never speaks. He's horrifying. He can't be killed. And he takes pleasure in killing a motherfucker. That's it. And now we've got this new franchise from David Gordon Green. I saw the first one, 2018 Halloween. I wasn't over the moon with it. It was fun to see Jamie Lee Curtis come back as Laurie Strode in a sort of weird reboot, reset, sort of direct sequel to the original Halloween, which kind of does away with all of the information we learned from the sequel on, where Laurie Strode was actually Myers herself. She was his sister. It all gets done away with. We skip all those movies. We go right from the first one to the 2018 remake slash sequel. And aside from seeing Laurie Strode come back, it really doesn't do a lot for me. I'm not honestly a gigantic fan of it. It's kind of akin to sort of Linda Hamilton coming back as Sarah Connor in Terminator Dark Fate, where it's really cool to see the actress return and be a badass and like be sort of like a survivalist who like went through some horrible shit, was traumatized for it, and had to become tough to survive and get by. The characterization doesn't really feel terribly earned in either of those movies, though. And in general, they just really fall flat because people tend to miss the mark of what made the originals so great in the first place. I did not see Halloween Kills. Honestly, like I said, 2018 Halloween did not do it for me. I thought the ending was incredibly limp and predictable, and I was just not a fan of this being built up as being like the final showdown between Laurie and Michael, and then of course they come up with a reason for Michael to survive and carry on. At this point, it just felt like sort of a cash grab. Halloween Kills had nothing for me. The memes were hilarious. The whole Evil Dies Tonight thing was really entertaining. And now I'm hearing that Halloween Ends is one of the worst pieces of shit ever. And as somebody who's grown up loving Michael Myers in the first at least two Halloween movies, I'm going to count Season of the Witches separately because it's entirely separate on its own. And then, of course, Halloween 4. Loving those three movies, I'm just going to do myself a favor of never seeing Halloween Ends and just not continue to sully the good name of Michael Myers, that horrible, sadistic son of a bitch. Speaking of Linda Hamilton and Sarah Connor and the Terminator franchise, I was actually having a conversation with my good friend Rena, who I mentioned before. She's one of the biggest horror movie aficionados I know, so I had to pose this question to her. And this question actually came to me from my good friend Seth, who you've heard on Space Castle before. And that sort of came about from a conversation we were having with other friends. And the question is whether or not Sarah Connor is actually a final girl. If you're not familiar with the trope, the final girl is the girl who survives at the end of every horror movie. She's the one who either outsmarts or defeats or kills the villain and ends up surviving, making it to the sequel, in most cases where the villain ends up coming back to life as well. But the final girl is the one who manages to keep her head on her shoulders, survive the killer, and move on and live to see another day. I am personally of the mind that Sarah Connor in the first Terminator movie is not a final girl. One, because I think the Terminator, while it does have some really strong horror elements, is more of a sci-fi thriller. And two, because it's just her and Kyle that are running away from the Terminator. I don't think you can really call her a final girl when it's just two people who are being chased by this killing machine. She does end up outsmarting the Terminator in the end and crushing it with that hydraulic press and surviving to the sequel. But I don't think she follows the trope closely enough to be considered a final girl in the same way that, say, like Ellen Ripley is in the Alien franchise. So, I had this conversation with my good friend Rena, and she agreed with me. And she's one of the smartest people I know when it comes to both metal music and horror movies. And in general, honestly, like, she's really fucking smart. She's kind of like my sister at this point. She's family, which is something I kind of frequently feel the need to apologize to her for. But she's of the mind that I am, that Sarah Connor is a great character. The Terminator franchise has some really strong horror elements to it, but Sarah Connor is not a final girl. I'm sorry, Seth. I'm sorry to all our friends, but my friend Rena is a definitive voice when it comes to horror movies. And that's it. She's not a final girl. But you might be a final person if you made it to the end of this episode of Space Castle. It's your clubhouse for all things nerdy. My name is DT, and I want to thank you so much for joining me and listening in as I list off my top five favorite horror movies ever. Once again, those are An American Werewolf in London from 1981, directed by John Landis. Number four is Night of the Living Dead from George A. Romero, which came out in 1968. Number three is A Nightmare on Elm Street, 1984, Wes Craven. Number two is The Thing, directed by John Carpenter in 1982. And number one, with a bullet, the undisputed champion of slasher horror movies, is Halloween, 1978, also directed by John Carpenter. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to support the show, please do so at patreon.com/spacecastlepod. If you want to tell me your top five favorite horror movies, please do so by following at Space Castle Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Thank you guys so much for listening, and always check your candy.